What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hey, Fidelity. How can I remember to invest every month?
With the Fidelity app, you can choose a schedule and set up recurring investments in stocks and ETFs.
Oh, that sounds easier than I thought.
You got this.
Yeah, I do. Now, where did I put my keys?
You will find them where you left them.
Investing involves risk, including risk of loss. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. There is a lot of evidence that we're in the midst of a pretty strong economy right now. Unemployment is down, businesses are hiring, and wages are creeping up. Economic growth was hot last quarter. So last night in Florida, President Trump did what presidents do. He took credit for all that good news.
Everyone that greets me says, "Hello, Mr. President. Congratulations on what you've done for the economy. It's the talk of the world." Now that we have the best economy in the history of our country, this is the time to straighten out the worst trade deals ever made by any country on earth.
But there is debate about how much credit Trump deserves for this strong economy, and there are concerns about deficits while those trade wars are spooking much of corporate America. This hour on Point, assessing Trump's economy. You can join us on air or online. How do you grade the economy now? How much credit do you give President Trump? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And let's start with the latest in the trade wars. And to help us do that, we're joined from Washington by Sarah McGregor. She's the lead trade editor for Bloomberg News. Sarah, welcome back to On Point. It's good to have you.
Hi, Anthony.
So Bloomberg reported yesterday on a sort of ratcheting up, I guess, of this trade war with China, that the Trump administration is considering higher tariffs, that China is accusing the U.S. of blackmail. Give us the latest.
Sure. So first, I guess the good news that we're hearing is that there are efforts to rekindle talks between the U.S. and China. If you remember earlier in the year, the Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, was leading the charge trying to get a deal with China to avoid these tariffs. The bad news is, in the meantime, it seems like this train of tariffs is just sort of barreling down the tracks. And Trump has ordered his U.S. Trade Representative, Robert Lighthizer, to maybe seek to raise to 25% from 10% tariffs on $200 billion of Chinese goods that the U.S. is considering putting in place, which would be a real escalation of tensions between the two countries. So it almost seems to be a wash at this point. It's hard to know which way the Trump administration is leaning, and are they really just kind of floating this idea of raising the tariffs to push China into a corner?
Mm. Now, Beijing is promising retaliatory measures if the Trump administration makes good on this. What are they referring to? What kind of retaliatory measures?
China has basically said it's going to be an eye for an eye on this trade war. So far, the Trump administration has put in place tariffs on $34 billion worth of Chinese imports. And China has hit right back and said, okay, we're going to hit $34 billion worth of U.S. goods. And that's so far what we've seen. But of course, the U.S. imports a lot more from China than China buys from the U.S. So if Trump does follow through on his promise to put tariffs on everything from China, $500 billion worth of goods a year, China, of course, wouldn't be able to retaliate 100% on the tariffs because it imports less. And so that's where things start to get a little bit foggy, because there's worries that China might hit back in other ways, including, you know, they could do things like consumer boycotts of U.S. goods. Some people cite their treasury holdings. They hold $1.2 trillion worth of bonds and treasury notes. And that would obviously really shake the U.S. market if they started unwinding those positions.
Hmm. Let's listen to a little bit of President Trump talking about, or at least making reference to these trade deals or this trade war in relationship to strong economic growth here in the United States. Here he is speaking outside the White House Friday morning, celebrating the 4.1% economic growth reported for this year's second quarter.
We're on track to hit the highest annual average growth rate in over 13 years. And I will say this right now, and I'll say it strongly, as the trade deals come in one by one, we're going to go a lot higher than these numbers, and these are great numbers.
So he's referring to as these trade deals come in one by one. Right now with China, it's more of a trade war. The administration has long complained that the U.S. is the victim of unfair trade practices. Is there any indication that his approach is having a persuasive effect on China?
So President Trump and his administration would argue that in order to get fundamental changes to China's economy to level the playing field over the long term, there might need to be this short-term pain from tariffs. And I think, you know, the warning that economists have given is starting to really take hold now. It's not really an imaginary situation that tariffs, you know, are going to hurt the economy in the short term. We have companies, car companies like GM, downgrading their earning forecast from these steel and aluminum tariffs earlier in the year. We see confidence indicators in Europe flashing a little red. China's currency has been dropping, and that's partly because people are worried about the economy because of these tariffs. And so I think that it's not theoretical anymore. There are some hints in the economy right now that the tariffs are going to take a bite. And I think it's just a matter of time for us to see whether, you know, the Trump administration can do what it says it wants to do with these, which is force China into the corner to give some concessions to them to change their economy so that it's fairer for U.S. companies who want to enter that market and get their, you know, footprint in there.
Yeah. And Sarah, let's remind us, too, if these tariffs go through, if the Trump administration doubles these tariffs in the way that they're talking about, what does that do to U.S. consumers? Remind us of that.
We've heard a lot. There's been some, you know, different hearings over the tariffs. Some last week, a lot of companies and a lot of consumer groups, you know, stood up. There's virtually no support for a lot of these tariffs, and a lot of companies have stood up and said, you know, we're going to have to raise our prices. It's basically a tax as items, you know, enter the U.S. Whether it's items that are put into products here and assembled and sold at Walmart or Target or the consumer goods themselves, and a lot of consumer groups say it's going to push up inflation, which of course could then impact interest rate decisions. And I think that the fear is that it could put the brakes on the economy. It's sort of cruising along right now, and you just aired a clip with Trump taking credit for this growth that we're seeing. And I think the fear is that it could put the brakes on it, and everyone remembers, you know, the recession. It was 10 years ago now, but it might now send the U.S. economy into a tough spot.
All right. Sarah McGregor, lead trade editor for Bloomberg News, speaking to us there. Sarah, thanks so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, let's move on. Meanwhile, back in Washington, there's talk of new tax cuts for the wealthy, and that's not going down well with everybody, as you can imagine. To talk a little about this, we're joined by Naomi Jagoda. She joins us from Washington. She covers tax policy for The Hill, and you can read her latest story on the proposed tax cut on our website, onpointradio.org. Naomi, welcome to On Point. Good to have you.
Hi, Anthony.
So let's start with a plan by congressional Republicans who are pushing a $100 billion tax cut that would be instituted without a vote by Congress. Can you give us a little background on this? What are we talking about here?
The Trump administration is looking at an idea that is very much supported by a number of prominent conservatives to take executive action, you know, something that it would do on their own without Congress, basically to cut capital gains taxes, and they would do this by adjusting capital gains for inflation.
I see. And so this would benefit, obviously, primarily people who pay capital gains taxes, so we're talking about the wealthy, and the windfall would be about $100 billion. What's the argument in favor of this coming from the Trump administration?
Well, Republicans kind of more broadly say that if you reduce capital gains taxes, it'll boost the economy, it'll increase incentives to make new investments, it will cause businesses and individuals to sell investments that they've been holding on to for a number of years. So they view this as a positive thing for the economy and a way to build on the economic success that they think that their tax cut law has had.
Right. And what's the pushback to this? Democrats are pushing back? If so, what are they saying?
Oh, yes. Democrats are definitely pushing back. As you mentioned, cutting capital gains taxes would largely benefit the wealthy, according to some estimates. And also the Penn Wharton budget model estimates that if you index capital gains, it would cost about $100 billion over a decade. And Democrats were upset that the tax cut bill added a significant amount to the debt, and this would just be additional money that would be added to the
right.
debt.
And Naomi, I gather there's debate as well about whether the administration has the authority to do this, to impose this without a vote of Congress by executive action.
Yes, and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin told the New York Times that he hasn't yet made a determination about whether they have the authority to do this.
All right. Meanwhile, there's talk in the House of another package of tax cuts, which would, among other things, permanently extend the tax cuts that were passed in 2017. This is being called Tax Cuts 2.0. Can you tell us a little bit about where this stands in the House among Republicans?
Yes. Well, House Republicans are very interested in this idea. The chairman of the Tax Writing Committee, Kevin Brady, a Republican from Texas, he released an outline last week about what this package might look like. And there were kind of three proposals in that. One is making the tax cuts for individuals in the 2017 law permanent. Another plank focuses on increasing incentives for people to save for retirement and education. And then the third plank focuses on trying to improve business innovation.
All right. So what is the likelihood that the House will take this up before the midterm elections? Because obviously there would be political opportunities, political risks debating this right before the midterms.
The House Republicans say they do want to have a vote on it before the midterms. I think Brady has said he'd like to see a vote in September. The bigger question is what happens to this in the Senate, mm-hmm. because this can pass in the House, you know, with only Republican support. But in the Senate, it would need the support of some Senate Democrats in order to pass. And it's probably unlikely that they have the support of enough Democrats to pass, so it probably would fail in the Senate. But at the same time, you could see some vulnerable Senate Democrats who are running for re-election in states that Trump carried to vote for it as an effort to show, you know, I do support making the middle class tax cuts permanent, and that could cause some political risk for Republicans.
All right. Naomi Jagoda, she covers tax policy for The Hill. She joined us from Washington. Naomi, thanks so much. We really appreciate your time today.
Thanks.
Listeners, we're taking measure of the U.S. economy right now. You can join the conversation. Are you seeing more jobs where you work? In your town, are you seeing wages starting to climb? Do you give credit to President Trump? I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're taking stock of the nation's economy. There's been a lot of good news of late and some debate if that's because of or in spite of President Trump's policies. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at onpointradio.org. And let me introduce Michael Strain. He's director of economic policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute. And he's just co-authored a story in the National Review entitled Trumponomics. And you can find a link to that at our website, onpointradio.org. Michael Strain, welcome to On Point. It's good to have you.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So I want to tick through some of these indicators and talk about really what they mean and how much credit the president deserves for them. But let me start with a really general question. It's not surprising that a president, all presidents would do this, will take credit for good times, for good economic times. But in general, how much control does a president have over the economy, over the performance of the economy?
Well, it's a great question. And I think we tend to overstate the degree to which a president should share the credit or the blame for the performance of the economy. You know, oftentimes, the public debate makes it seem like if the economy did well this quarter, it's because of things the president did. If the economy did poorly that quarter, it's because there are things the president should have done that he didn't, or some of the policies are backfiring or something like that. And it's certainly the case that public policy can impact the economy, particularly public policy, you know, as dramatic as the corporate tax cut that President Trump put forward, as the welfare reform that President Clinton put forward, as the tax cuts that President Reagan put forward. I mean, there are things that presidents can do, that public policy does, that do impact the economy. But I think, as a general matter, the economy is mostly shaped by the decisions of businesses and households. Those decisions are impacted by public policy, but public policy is not the only thing acting on those decisions. And we tend to overstate the degree to which the president really has control over the economy.
I think that's a great caveat to sort of put at the top of this conversation. It's why I wanted to ask that question, and I loved your answer. But let's talk about the big piece of legislation that the president passed, the Republican tax cut. Is it too soon to judge the success or failure of this? Is it too soon to assess the impact that this has had on the economy?
So I would actually separate those two questions. So I do think it's too soon to judge whether it's a success or a failure. And that's because the goal of cutting the corporate tax rate, which was the most important component of the tax bill, in my view, is to stimulate investment on the part of businesses. Increased investment should increase the productivity of workers. Workers who are more productive should earn higher wages. And it is too soon for that process to have taken effect. Hmm. That will require several years. Investment decisions often take some time. It takes time for workers to become more productive with the additional capital that they have access to. It takes time for that to filter into wages. So I think if we're trying to judge the success or failure of the tax bill, it is too early.
Yeah.
It's not too early to judge whether the tax bill is having some impact on the economy. And that's because the tax bill increases the federal budget deficit. And there will be some short-term effects of a larger budget deficit. And we saw some of those in the GDP report that came out, and we'll continue to see those this year and next. So there is an impact already, but that impact is separate from the kind of longer-term, more structural impact that proponents of the corporate tax cut were hoping would happen.
Listeners, we're talking about the current economy, how good it is, and how much credit any president, this president specifically, deserves for a good economy when economic times are reasonably good, as they seem to be right now. My guest is Michael Strain, Director of Economic Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. Michael, I'd love to just tick through a couple of these indicators that we spend a lot of time talking about. So let me start with second quarter economic growth, 4.1%. That's a pretty strong number. Is GDP growth much better under the Trump administration than in previous years?
Well, I think certainly 4.1% is a great number. It's important to point out that quarterly GDP, which is what that 4.1% number was, can be pretty volatile.
Right.
President Obama had some very good quarters, and he had some quarters that would be considered more lackluster. President Trump has had a good quarter, also had some quarters that you might consider more lackluster. So I think it's important to kind of look at the longer-term trend in GDP growth. And, there, I think what we're seeing is, pretty much a continuation of what we saw under President Obama. That may change going forward as some of the president's policies have had more time to really take hold in the economy. But from what we've seen so far, the basic story of the recovery from the Great Recession kind of continues. We're still chugging along at a pretty solid but unspectacular underlying rate of growth.
Right. So roughly what it was during Obama's second term in terms of economic – the average number around economic growth. Fair to say?
I think it's reasonable to conclude that the kind of underlying rate of growth is quite similar.
Right. So what about hiring, unemployment? The unemployment rate is as low as it's been in two decades. To what extent is that the result of the president's policy? Or are we seeing essentially – we've been seeing sort of steady improvement of that for years now.
Well, we've certainly been seeing steady improvement in the unemployment rate for years. The unemployment rate was as high as 10%, and we are now around 4%, and that's a pretty dramatic decline. Most of that decline happened under President Obama. Some has happened under President Trump as well. And I think a lot of economists anticipate that the unemployment rate could drop even further by a half a percentage point or so lower than where we currently are. And so that obviously would occur under President Trump's watch as well.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not President Trump's policies have had some impact here, I think they have. The efforts to deregulate the economy likely will have a positive impact on the economy. The president seems to have stirred up the animal spirits of businesses and investors. That's you can find evidence of that in anecdotes. You can also find evidence of that in surveys. And we would think that kind of more optimism on the part of economic actors like businesses should translate into some increase in economic performance. And like I said, the tax cuts coupled with increases in federal discretionary spending have juiced the economy. Now, whether or not it makes sense to juice an economy with a 4% unemployment rate is something that could be debated. But the fact that surge of stimulus did have a measurable impact on GDP and will continue to have an impact on GDP this year and next is something that I think most economists would agree with, and that's going to impact the economy and the labor market as well. So there are things that are happening here,
yeah.
But kind of under the surface, things are looking pretty similar.
Let me ask you about another indicator. Throughout the Obama presidency, as the economy improved slowly, there was always a lot of concern about relatively stagnant wages. Most Americans weren't reaping the benefit of an improving economy, and a lot of Americans weren't reaping those benefits of an improving economy in their paychecks. Then towards the end of his presidency, there was evidence of some modest wage growth. We're seeing that continue today. So what about wage growth under President Trump? Is this a continuation of what we had, or is there something new sort of ticking up here?
Well, I think you can point to an acceleration of wages over the past several years. Whether or not that acceleration began in the later years of the Obama term, kind of depends on some technical questions about how you measure wages and what statistics you look at. But I think there does seem to be kind of some acceleration in wages. Especially if you look at measures like total compensation, for example, instead of just wage and salary payments. But the performance of wages continues to be something that economists are puzzling over. You would expect in an economy that looks so good when you look at the unemployment rate, when you look at GDP, when you look at monthly job gains, you would expect to see wages growing more strongly than they are. I believe that the explanation to that is largely a productivity story, that productivity growth has been somewhat lackluster, and that's translating into wages not accelerating as rapidly as we would hope. There's some debate over that. Certainly, the president's tax cuts should have an impact on productivity. But again, it's a little too early for that.
A little too early to know that for sure. Michael Strain, stand by. I want to introduce Steve Leisman. He's senior economics reporter for CNBC. And you can find a link to his most recent reporting at our website, onpointradio.org. Steve, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Oh, great to be here.
I know you've been listening along for a while, and sort of the basic question here is how much any president, whether times are good, times are bad, takes credit or gets blamed for the economy. What's your view on this as someone who has covered this issue for a while?
Yeah, a couple decades. I think that fiscal policy is important. It's important in the long run, as Michael was talking about. And I guess my remark on Friday when that 4.1% GDP report came out was President Trump is probably right to take a victory lap, but probably went around the track too many times. and I think one way to think about that is think about what President Trump says about Black or African American unemployment, which has gone down and hit all-time low records under his during his presidency. So if you want to write this down at home, when he came into office, Black unemployment was about 7.8%, and it's fallen now to some of those low levels. 5.9 was the low. It's now at 6.5. So let's give him credit for 1.5 percentage points. Under President Obama, in 2010, that number was near 17%, and it came down to near 8%. So 8 full percentage points under President Obama and 1.5 percentage points. So, yeah, Black unemployment rate has gone down to some of the lowest levels under President Trump, but the vast majority of that came down under President Obama. I think what we're in the middle of is a very interesting discussion about how much any of these policies will ultimately matter and how much a president should take credit for all of it. The trouble is that President Trump keeps upping the game in terms of his rhetoric, and the best, the most historic, very little of that is true. What's probably true is, you know, Michael's great piece the other day, I guess it's on the AEI website, that kind of tries to tease out how much of this is just continuation of trend and how much of this is really new and different. I think his comments on the psychology, some of the animal spirit stuff, that does seem to be new. There was a break. There was a break in the stock market upon the election of President Trump, and a very strong surge in some of the confidence polls among businesses and even consumers. That's for sure. But some of these other things are just continuations of trends that were in place ahead of time. And certainly President Trump could say he didn't mess it up.
Yeah. Steve, I'm glad you mentioned Michael's piece that he co-authored for the National Review. You can find a link to that at onpointradio.org. It's called Trumponomics. It's a great piece. It's very much guiding sort of the framework of this conversation today. Steve, let me just stick with you and I'll come back to you, Michael, and also want to go to our listeners. But you mentioned the stock market. It has gone up. There's been a few bumps, but there's no question overall since President Trump has taken office, it's up quite dramatically. We need to remind ourselves the stock market isn't the economy or isn't the total economy, but it is an indicator. So what do we make of the stock market under President Trump? What does it indicate is going right?
Well, I think the market correctly teased out there was going to be a very strong business-oriented tax cut from the very beginning. And I have to say, there were a lot of economists who predicted stock market doom upon the election of President Trump. And to be fair to them, the market traded as if there would be doom under President Trump, which is interesting enough. There were a bunch of event studies that were done that showed that every time it looked like the President Trump was doing better in the pre-election polls, that the market fell. And the turnaround upon the results was really quite remarkable. I think earnings are doing well. I think, you have this massive tax cut that goes right to the bottom line in a way that's really quite incredible. Just by way of context, before President Trump's election, the debate in Washington was whether or not you should cut the corporate tax from, say, a top rate of 35% to 28% the Democrats wanted and 25% the Republicans wanted. President Trump comes along and said it ought to be 15. They ended up at 21. And again, that flows right to the bottom line. You have better economic growth. And then there's the issue of corporate profits as a percentage of the total economy, which we sort of generally call the profit margin, and that has been very high. And not as much of that is going to workers. And I don't know if you got into this issue with Michael, but the issue of economic equality is going to be a big issue. I mean, workers are doing somewhat better, depending upon how you look at and which wage data you track. But the idea that there are massive stock buybacks right now, that is flowing directly to the bottom line, more of the wealthy. And we're not seeing, and I think your most ardent Republican would argue this was not a tax cut oriented towards individuals.
Yeah, interesting. Michael Strain, I'd like to come back to you. Another indicator about where we stand now. What about federal deficits and debt? As a share of the economy, federal deficits did grow under President Obama. How are we doing now under President Trump?
Well, we've seen a significant increase in the deficit due to the president's tax cut and due to the increase in federal spending that I mentioned earlier. And those policies are having a positive effect on GDP this year, and that will likely continue into next year as well. But there's a flip side to that. If we don't reduce the debt, then those policies will ultimately prove to be a drag on the economy and will slow economic growth, will depress investment and push down productivity and wages as a consequence. So it's extremely important to address the debt. This is an area where President Trump is not doing well. The main drivers of the debt are spending on longer-term retirement programs like Social Security and Medicare. The president has explicitly said he doesn't want to touch those programs. And in addition to that, he took a big chunk out of federal revenue with the tax cut. So,
so that remains to be seen. I mean, this could be problems down the road. We'll talk about that after the break. I'm talking to Michael Strain, Director of Economic Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute, and Steve Leisman, Senior Economics Reporter for CNBC. And we're assessing the state of the U.S. economy, asking how much credit President Trump deserves. When we return, a former top economic advisor to Democratic presidents and your calls. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
I'm Ann Powers from NPR Music. Last summer, we launched Turning the Tables, a project that radically changed how we talk about the history of popular music, with a list of the 150 greatest albums by women. This week, we're launching Season 2, looking at the 200 greatest songs by 21st century women. Check out who made the list and who didn't at n.pr/turningthetables.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about the assortment of economic indicators, jobs numbers, wage growth, GDP, trade wars, tax cuts, and asking, how good is this economy? To what extent does President Trump deserve credit for it? So here's Larry Kudlow, director of the President's National Economic Council, on Fox News on Friday, just after the administration released its new numbers for the second quarter, a robust 4.1% growth.
We've lowered tax rates, we've rolled back regulations, we've unleashed energy, we're moving to fix a broken world trading system. You can see big numbers on capital spending, business investment. This is a good story. My hunch is it's going to go on for quite a while. It's not just one quarter.
All right, so there's the take from the Trump administration. My guests are Steve Leisman, senior economics reporter for CNBC, and Michael Strain, director of economic policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute. And gentlemen, let's go to some calls. Let's go to Bob, who's calling from Brevard, North Carolina. Bob, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Anthony. Thanks. I just want to say that, that has been Obama's fifth best quarter of GDP growth. So, if Trump is going to blame the president for everything, then he also should give him some credit for some of the things that he did. And the other thing is that, what we're not talking about here is the 900-pound Leviathan in the room that's equal to both Beast of the Apocalypse, which is the budget deficit and our multi-trillion-dollar debt, which is crowding private capital out of the bond market. It's keeping long-term interest rates high, which means that it's going to push mortgage rates higher. And the reality is that housing and home ownership is such an important part of this economy. And if we cannot do something to spur those sectors of the economy and also to reduce the budget deficit, long-term, we have serious structural problems in the American economy that are directly the result of this great lie of the 20th century, which is supply-side economics, this riverboat gamble that all the Republicans drink the Kool-Aid of.
All right, we got it, Bob. I mean, Michael Strain had begun to address this before the break, but Michael, pick that up again, this idea that deficits running out of control can crowd out a lot of the oxygen in an otherwise healthy economy.
Yeah, I think it's a real issue, and it's an issue that presidents of both parties have contributed to. George W. Bush, Barack Obama, Donald Trump have all made our deficit and debt situation worse. The concerns that we're a few months away from a debt crisis or something like that, I think are overblown. But I also think that we need to take seriously the fact that unless we reduce the trajectory of the debt, change the trajectory of the debt so the debt as a share of GDP is declining rather than increasing, then we will have negative economic consequences from that. We will have a slower GDP growth. We will have a less productive workforce that can command lower wages in the labor market. And our standard of living will drop relative to what it should be. We also run the risk of not being able to adequately respond to major macroeconomic events like a financial crisis, like a recession. We open ourselves up to more serious consequences depending on how much more serious the situation gets. But this is something that Washington should be taking seriously. It's something that President Trump is not taking seriously, and I think it's a major weakness in his economic policy program.
Yeah, Steve Leisman, I mean, it's interesting. The Republican Party for a long time was the party of the deficit hawks. That doesn't seem to be true of Trump's brand of Republicanism.
No, and it wasn't true of other brands of Republicanism either. They have never really hewed to that when they were in power. One of the ways that growth was kept down during the Obama years was after the initial financial crisis spending package, government spending was really down during a lot of the Obama administration, or not as much growth as would have been commensurate with the economy. The trouble with the whole deficit story is it doesn't matter until it matters. Right now, you have about a 3% cost of money over 10 years for the government, which is not tremendously onerous. And all the people who have said that at X percent of GDP, the debt will create a crisis have been wrong essentially all the way up. And now we're, depending on how you want to measure it, 70 or 80% of GDP. And we seem to be able to finance our deficit just fine. There's plenty of takers when it comes to domestically and abroad. The reason to keep the deficit low is one that no politician can ever internalize, which Michael mentioned briefly there, this idea that once we come to a recession, what's our fiscal ability to respond? That's one. And two is you just don't know where that break point is. It could be 100% of GDP or 150% of GDP, but the costs to society are so tremendous that it makes sense to be prudent ahead of time, even if you don't know where that limit is.
Interesting. I want to introduce Neera Tanden. She's president and CEO of the Center for American Progress. She's worked for Presidents Clinton and Obama and for Senator Hillary Clinton on health care and domestic policy. Neera Tanden, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Anthony.
Hello there. So give us your quick take. There are some strong economic indicators out there. President Trump takes credit for a lot of them. How much credit do you give the president?
You know, I think there's a key irony here, which is that we have an economy that has for many years now been doing well on issues like overall unemployment and strained from some quarters, but has also had good quarters of growth. But I think the central argument that Donald Trump made during the election was that, you know, working people were not seeing the benefits of the economy. He made fun of the unemployment numbers, but he basically said over and over again that working Americans, working class Americans, were essentially not seeing the benefits of growth. And I think there was some significant truth to that. And the central challenge in this economy, and in many ways it's actually getting worse, is that we live at a time where corporate profitability is exceedingly high and getting higher as a result of the tax cut. But the experience that most people have in this economy is not improving. Wages are not increasing. In fact, since the tax cut was passed, according to some data, wages have actually been down. And so,
but Neera, aren't they on that one? And again, I'm only sort of citing what I'm reading. Aren't wages creeping up much as they were under President Obama? So is it really fair to say they're not doing as well as they should be under President Trump?
Well, the last couple of quarters, they've not. And the I think the central issue here is Donald Trump had an economic policy that he put forward. It was his tax cut program. He argued that his tax cut program was his economic policy. There was the argument Republicans made in the tax cut was that wages, this tax cut would redound to the benefit of workers' paychecks. It was a tax cut that disproportionately favored the wealthy. It was a corporate tax cut in most part. The argument was that corporate tax cut would be used by corporations to increase wages. And that has not happened. Most of the money has gone to shareholder buybacks. And the truth of it is we could see that coming because corporations have been highly profitable over the last several years. And they've used that profitability not to boost wages. And the tax cut is just another form, another way to boost corporate profitability.
Michael Strain, I mean, earlier in the hour, Michael, you said that it might be a little too soon to assess completely the president's tax cut law. What do you think? I mean, how long do we have to wait before we can say, yeah, Nir is right. Workers haven't really benefited from this.
Yeah, I disagree with a lot of what Nira said, and that's a big part of the reason why. I think that we need to wait, at least a few years, at least 2 years, in order to, look at the productivity statistics, look at the wage statistics, and see whether or not increased business investment actually is accruing to the benefit of workers.
Why?
Part of the confusion around this, I think, is driven by the administration, kind of understandably trying to hype the short-term immediate benefits of the tax cut. But there's a fundamental misunderstanding that I think is reflected in Nira's comments. The idea was not that you give corporations more money by lowering their tax rates and then looking to see what corporations do with that extra money. And does that extra money go to workers or does that extra money go to shareholders? That fundamentally misunderstands the economics at play here. The question is whether by making investment more profitable, do you increase investment? And if you increase investment, does that translate into productivity and wage growth? And that requires some time.
So, Nira, what do you think of that?
Michael, I want to respond.
False. Yeah. I think that's just wrong. I mean, the truth is that the argument that Republicans made during this process was that, and you saw it immediately after the bill passed, they had a spate of stories about increased wages. The argument they made, and it's not my argument, it was their argument, and they made it directly. Companies would take these profits, basically. We are adding to the profitability of companies, and those companies will translate. Everyone within the company will benefit. And if you want to have a policy to increase productivity, and I do think we do need to increase productivity, you could increase investment. You could do a bunch of other things. Adding to the corporate bottom line of a company is not necessarily the fastest way to do that.
Interesting.
But that was the argument that Republicans made. And I think the truth is we actually can see in real time corporate behavior from the benefit of the tax cut. Corporations are behaving, obviously not every corporation is the same, but we see that tax cut translating into an increase in shareholder buybacks, a broad trend, but an acceleration of shareholder buybacks, and we do see an increase in CEO pay.
I'm going to jump in here because
the tax cut, but yep, they are accelerated by the tax cut.
Let me jump in here. We're just going to agree that you two are going to disagree. But Steve Leisman, you wanted to get in on this conversation, on this part of the conversation.
I'll try to do this quickly. Separation of two things. First, there's the individual side of the tax cut. Then there's the business side. On the individual side, our polling data from CNBC shows only 34% of the public are seeing more money in their paychecks because of the tax cuts. 49% are not. And by the way, that includes a decent number of Republicans who are saying that. So that's one problem, and I think it's a problem the administration has. It's one of the reasons perhaps why Republicans are not necessarily running on this tax cut. I understand the administration's idea, and I understand Michael's explanation of it. What I don't get are two things. One is the incredible number of CEOs who come through CNBC and talk to us on a daily basis that tell us the tax cut is not going to change their investment plans. That's one. And two is the idea that when you ask them, well, you're getting an extra percent, like, well, we're making 5, 10, and 15-year investments, and that the tax is only a very small piece of that whole decision-making puzzle. And three, the idea that if companies are getting, as they have been, a bigger share of each extra dollar of productivity today, why will that change tomorrow because of the tax cut? Companies will make more money, but there's no guarantee that workers get a share of that more money.
Interesting. Listen, our time runs short. I want to be sure to get at least a couple more callers into this conversation. So let's go to Dallas, who's calling from Tampa, Florida. Dallas, you're on the air. Thanks for the call.
Hi, Anthony. Yeah, I'm a business person, a long-time business person, and I think that the main thing that Donald Trump brings to being a president of the United States is that he has been a businessman all of his life. He understands that you have to pay employees, you have to pay your bills, you have to get things done. And most of the people that have occupied the White House in the past have been career politicians with maybe some business experience. Certainly Obama had almost no business experience, so I think that him being in the White House creates confidence among the business community, and that really is what he's bringing to the table.
All right, Dallas, we got it. So a vote there suggesting that President Trump deserves a good deal of credit for what's going on. Let's go to Wes, who's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Go ahead, Wes. You're on the air.
Hi, Anthony. The Speaker of the House, to say that the tax cuts were not sold as a middle-class tax benefit to benefit the middle class is completely false. The Speaker of the House said that they are supposed to benefit the middle class. And in an interesting Freudian slip, Trump in his tweet yesterday or day before said when he was trying to ridicule the Koch brothers that that the tax cuts made them richer, which is an interesting it's a dichotomy regarding middle class tax cuts.
All right, Wes, we got it. Well, I mean, near a tangent, it's probably true that the tax cuts made the Koch brothers a lot richer, right?
Yeah, I would say that was an unusual statement of fact in one of the president's tweets. I wanted to say one point about business investment, which I think is a really critical issue, and is part of actual growth in the country. And we've had a divergence between business investment and profitability over the last several years. It did not just start. But one critical issue is that we have not seen, post the tax cut, the corporate tax cut, a surge in business investment. And I think that, just to go to Steve's point, and CEOs have said themselves in polls and questionnaires that they're not going to do a dramatic increase in business investment. So I think that is part of the challenge. Business investment would be a part of increased pay, also direct raising of wages in companies would have been part of pay. But that's a critical dichotomy. And one of the reasons why a lot of people thought that the tax cut strategy may not be the best economic growth strategy for the long term.
Michael Strain, we have literally 10 or 15 seconds left here. I'd love to ask you for sort of what you're looking for. You've sort of counseled it's going to take some time to assess this. What's the next marker that you're looking for?
Well, I think investment and then some action on the productivity statistics would be great to see.
All right. Well, we'll wait and see if that happens. Michael Strain, Director of Economic Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. Thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Nina Tandon is President and CEO of the Center for American Progress. Nina, thank you as well.
Thanks.
And Steve Leisman, Senior Economics Reporter for CNBC. Always great to have you on the show. Steve, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.